Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Who do you believe when it comes to the economy and jobs? Maybe a politician like John Boehner.
This economy went through a very difficult meltdown. And over the course of the last year, the policies that are coming out of this administration have caused us to lose more jobs.
But when politics get involved, the numbers get smudgy. Ask an economist, she'll probably tell you that the economy is growing, unemployment is falling, and we'll probably start adding jobs next month. So who's right? Separating rumor from rhetoric. What's the buzz? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 1st. It's the first day of February, the second month of the year already. The takeaway for me on the economy is it's kind of like weight loss. They tell you don't check your weight every single day. If you really want to get a good idea of it, do it only like once a week to get the broader picture.
What's an economist to do then? Buzz economics on the takeaway. I love that. President Obama, weekend budget warrior.
We've heard plenty of talk and a lot of yelling on TV about deficits, and it's now time to come together and make the painful choices we need to eliminate those deficits.
The president speaking over the weekend about the big story today, the president unveiling a $4 trillion, nearly $4 trillion budget, calling for billions in new spending to combat unemployment while slashing $700 billion for domestic programs. It also raises taxes on banks and people making over $250,000 a year. When the dust settles, the federal deficit will rise to a record $1.6 trillion this year, or almost 11% of the nation's gross domestic product.
Joining us now is Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. So, Marcus, when you're looking at the economic numbers, who's the most reliable?
The most reliable are the actual independent economists and the
professional
budget
economists.
So when what you have to do when you want to understand really what's at stake is you have to kind of looking at the partisan economists on the right and left is do what they do in Europe when they read newspapers. You read the right, you read the left, and you average them together and get the center.
Okay, well, we're going to be getting the center from you in just a moment, so stay with us.
Toyota says it will have answers today for the millions of drivers affected by last week's massive recall. In about a half an hour, Toyota will announce its plan to fix gas pedals for nearly 4 million cars and trucks. In Haiti now. Voices of orphaned children singing at a special camp in Port-au-Prince set up for them. Aid agencies are rushing to find thousands of children made homeless by the earthquake, many of whom are still roaming the streets. This comes as 10 Americans will be in court today on suspicion of trying to take 33 children out of the country without permission. This pastor, who's from the same Idaho church as many of the Americans being held, says it was an honest mistake.
It was just largely a misunderstanding that they thought they had the paperwork they needed. It appears that they were missing a particular document.
Meanwhile, the airlift of injured Haitians to the U.S. for medical treatment will resume today. Flights had been suspended for several days after hospitals in Florida complained they were overloaded.
For the past 25 years, the main Pentagon strategy has been preparing the military to fight two conventional wars at once. Today, the Pentagon says it will refocus the military on being ready for numerous smaller conflicts at the same time. And it was ladies' night at the Grammys. Beyoncé was the big winner. She took home 6 awards. That's a record. She did, though, lose Album of the Year to country queen Taylor Swift. Swift took home 4 awards on her own. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are up. European indices are mixed. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,067, the S&P at 1,073, and the NASDAQ opens at 2147. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk about family life because it's Monday, and we're going to ask how do couples stay together? If money is the number one cause of divorce, can you keep your money separate? Talk about that later.
The president tightening the nation's belt.
Like any cash-strapped family, we will work within a budget to invest in what we need and sacrifice what we don't.
Are you any cash-strapped family? Call us and tell us how you are managing your budget woes. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. All the agenda this morning with Marcus Mabry and Rob Watson of the BBC. Good morning, everyone. The earthquake in Haiti and its aftermath have dominated headlines for the past 3 weeks. Pictures of devastation and hope, we've all seen them. Frantic aid efforts, frustrated survivors hanging onto an international lifeline, the aid telethons, the military airlifts. Haiti, however, beyond these headlines, is a challenge for the entire 21st century, as much as it is an opportunity. If Haiti's plight can be addressed in a way that is sustainable beyond this latest disaster, it could resonate throughout the century, where all kinds of social problems and regions of political instability depend on finding ways to make developing nations sustainably prosperous. All this week, we're going to be asking experts for their thoughts on how Haiti might best rebuild and how the international community can usefully help. We're rejoined by Paul Collier, a special advisor to Haiti with the United Nations Secretary General back in 2009 and the author of the book, The Bottom Billion, Why the Poorest Countries Are Failing and What Can Be Done About It. Once again, Professor Collier, good morning.
Good morning.
So you described a staircase of aid strategies that get beyond the short term and move into sort of long-term sustainable development. Let me ask you right off the top, is Haiti a hard problem or is Haiti a relatively easy problem? And I made the comparison to the Marshall Plan there at the top of the hour.
Haiti is a relatively easy problem by the standards of fragile states today. Haiti is not Afghanistan. Afghanistan, I think, is hard. Haiti, I think, is easy.
And what is it about Haiti that makes it easy? You've written that Haiti, at least on paper, has an extraordinarily productive potential in agriculture and might even actually be a place for light manufacturing. Describe.
It's full of economic opportunities. As you say, mangoes, fantastic. They're the best quality mangoes in the world. They rot on the trees just offshore from the biggest mango market on earth. So getting the logistics of getting those mangoes to market, that's not rocket science. It can be done, and that's a big livelihood earner for Haitians.
And there's also coffee, right?
There's coffee. So within agriculture, mangoes are just an example of the commercialization of agriculture potential. In light manufacturing, Haiti's got a very good trade deal with America, Hope 2, that gives good market access for light manufacturers, garments and such like. It's got a very good workforce. There's just simple impediments like electricity, functioning ports. These things are very readily fixable. Haiti is offshore from the biggest market on earth. Afghanistan and many countries like it
right.
are landlocked thousands of miles away from a market.
Well, let's take a look at some of the aid efforts that were well underway before this earthquake. I mean, former President Clinton famously assembled a group of private investors to put up something on the order of $200 million. But I'm wondering if that was going to be spent on precisely the things that you think are important. Development of electricity, the upgrading of the port, the creation of the kind of infrastructure that's actually going to support those businesses. As far as I can tell, it's mostly hotels and tourism.
Well, hotels and tourism is no bad thing. That's one opportunity. Haiti's got a lot of opportunity in tourism, so I don't want to knock that at all. There's also a lot of money was committed to building factories. George Soros put up over $25 million as part of that initiative to create new factory space. So, yes, there were things happening. There should be much more happening, and now's the chance to do it on electricity in the ports. Those were the big things to fix, and they're fixable.
Without a government, though, why would private investors even go into Haiti?
Of course there's got to be a government, but the range of what the government's got to do is not very great. Do we know how to supply electricity reliably and cheaply? Of course we do. Do we know how a port should function? Of course we do. These are doable things, and they'll be done now.
The question is really, will the Haitian people trust the government to do those sorts of things? And we've heard again and again, Paul Collier, professor of economics director of the Center for the Study of African Economics at Oxford University, we've heard time and time again that people just don't trust the Haitian government to carry out even these kinds of redevelopment efforts. And listen here, if you would, Paul Collier, to the motivations, in the words of the late historian Larry Bland, talking about the Marshall Plan, why the U.S. and ultimately the investors who went into Europe after World War II got involved.
Prime motivation for launching the Marshall Plan was fear of chaos in Western Europe. You could see this if you went to the movies every weekend on the beginning of the feature where they'd show problems in Europe on the newsreels. Starving women and children affect Americans' hearts.
So, Paul Collier, how come we don't fear chaos in Haiti as much as we feared chaos in Europe after World War II?
Well, there isn't the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons sitting next door. So, the downside risk is smaller. But Haiti now is where Europe was in the late 40s. We forget just how fragile Europe was then. Of course, Haiti's very small. This is a very fixable problem. Sure, the Haitian government in the past has not had a good record, and it's important to build decision structures that work within Haiti and internationally. I mean, what I've been suggesting is a dual decision structure of a respected Haitian, a prime minister, a former prime minister, whatever, and a respected international leader such as Bill Clinton, who co-lead a temporary effort, maybe 3 or 4 years, where they have the power of money and the power of implementation for things like electricity in the ports.
Interesting. So a distribution of sovereignty there, that would be unprecedented, and it sounds very 21st century, if you ask me. What are the triggers we should look for that would show that, in fact, enough was in place to possibly trigger a sustainable river of private sector investment in a place like Haiti?
Well, first, let's look for sustainable housing. So not tents, but simple one-room buildings that can then be expanded down the line. Let's look for those houses to be located in places where economic opportunity can be built alongside them. So we're solving the residential problem and the jobs problem at the same time.
So permanent housing located near infrastructure that would support jobs, that cycle then attracts investment. Paul Collier, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of African Economies at Oxford University. He's the author of The Bottom Billion, Why the Poorest Countries Are Failing and What Can Be Done About It. He was a special advisor on Haiti to the United Nations Secretary General in 2009. The idea of a Marshall Plan in Haiti. It's a lesson for the 21st century on The Takeaway. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the other stories we're following.
The president unveils his $3.8 trillion budget proposal this morning. One key area of spending, a $100 billion jobs bill. But the budget will also lead to a $1.6 trillion deficit. On CNN, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said the president hasn't forgotten about his promise to cut the deficit by half during his first term. But he says current economic circumstances have created new priorities.
The president is committed to keeping that goal, understanding that, as you said, this recession was deeper than we thought it was going to be.
The budget cuts funding for hundreds of federal programs and raises taxes on big banks and the wealthy. Toyota is telling dealers they should get parts to fix the problematic gas pedals for that recall later this week. We'll get more on that in just a few minutes.
Taliban leaders have said no to reconciliation. They've told Afghan President Hamid Karzai they won't consider reintegrating into Afghan society until international forces pull out of the country. Lower-level Taliban are reintegrating, however. Meanwhile, January was the second deadliest month for U.S. troops since the war began. In Pakistan, officials are trying to confirm reports that a major Taliban leader, Hakimullah Massoud, was killed last month by a U.S. drone attack. Massoud is linked to the deadly suicide bombing against the CIA in Afghanistan late last year. Back at home, Amazon.com is giving in to pricing demands from publisher Macmillan on electronic books. Prices for e-book bestsellers will likely increase to between $3 and $5. It's the 50th anniversary of the 1960 Woolworth sit-in in Greensboro, North Carolina. It was a historic anti-discrimination turning point in America. Let's look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some news takeouts, and Toyota is telling people that they are sending out the parts that are needed to repair the sticky gas pedal problem that's at the root of the recall of nearly 8 million vehicles since November. Jim Lentz, the president and chief operating officer of Toyota Motor Sales, appeared on NBC this morning.
The number of accidents, whether it's one or whether it's 2,000, doesn't really make a difference. We've been investigating this for a long time.
The announcement comes a day after federal officials opened an investigation into the manufacturer that sold defective accelerators to Toyota. Nick Buckling joins us now. He's the New York Times auto industry reporter. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this solution of installing this, I guess it's a steel bar to prevent the gas pedal from sticking, that's a low-cost solution. Will it fix the problem?
Well, Toyota says that they are confident and convinced that this will fix the problem with unintended acceleration, as it's called, although there's still some in the industry that are not quite sure that this is going to resolve everything that's going on here.
And as we said, federal officials are investigating the manufacturer who made these accelerators, so maybe it's not Toyota's problem, except that they should have checked it better.
Well, and Toyota has their philosophy that even though suppliers make a lot of the parts on their cars, that they say, you know, these are Toyota cars, this is our responsibility. They essentially say that all the parts coming into their vehicles are their problem, so they know they have to fix it.
So, Nick Bunkley, you heard Jim Lynch saying it doesn't matter if it's one accident or 1,000. How many accidents do we know are linked to this problem?
Well, there's a number out there, and some of them have involved fatalities. There were at least two that have been in the news quite a bit lately that each involved four people dying when cars were supposedly speeding out of control. One was in Texas last month, and one was in San Diego back in August.
Okay, Nick Bunkley is the New York Times auto industry reporter. Thanks, Nick.
Our next takeout comes from Dudley Althaus, Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle. He joins us from that city. Dudley, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Tell us about this brutal story that took place over the weekend in Ciudad Juarez on the border between the U.S. and Mexico.
Yeah, this was particularly nasty. As many as 15 gunmen stormed into a party being held in a poor neighborhood in Juarez and rounded up a bunch of the kids that were partying there and just started executing them. This is in a neighborhood sort of near the police station of Juarez. Parents of the children said they had absolutely nothing to do with organized crime or with the drug trade in that city, and everybody's just confused why they would have been attacked.
Well, one thing that sort of ratchets up the brutality here is apparently most of them were high school football players.
Well, a lot of them were high school football players. Some of them, one of the students that was killed, had just received an award from the state's governor for his academic achievements. These, by all accounts, were good kids.
And so the message here from the drug traffickers and the armed militia is you are not safe no matter where you are, no matter who you are. Is that fair?
That's pretty much fair, and it goes against the common wisdom here that if you're not involved in the drug trade, you're pretty much safe. And so, yeah, this is disturbing. What's even more disturbing is it's really not getting major play in the national news in Mexico.
Wow.
It's getting play, but it's kind of people are getting blasé about this sort of thing, and that's scary.
But overall, potentially a serious problem for Mexican President Felipe Calderon. Dudley Althaus reporting on the brutal situation in the drug trafficking wars down in Mexico that are constantly creating brutal scenes on the border with the United States. He's Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle.
Well, when was the last time you linked Henry Paulson with salacious literature? We're talking about Henry, former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, is releasing his memoir, On the Brink, Inside the Race to Stop the Collapse of the Global Financial System. And Louise Story, our partner, for our finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is with us. So what is in this book that's surprising?
Well, you know, all of us who've covered this financial crisis and anyone on Wall Street was very avidly flipping through the pages of this book this weekend. This is the first person who is really running the response to the crisis or involved in it who's written a memoir. I mean, you've seen probably 20 books out there by journalists, but you haven't seen Dick Folds, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, write a book, and you haven't seen, you know, Tim Geithner write a book. This is the first up-close book. And there's a little, you know, you do get a sense of some of his personal moments. He tells a story that a lot of people have been talking about on Saturday, September 13th, which was the weekend Lehman was failing. He tells a story. He's a devout Christian Scientist, and he's in New York at a hotel, having been at the New York Fed all day, and he needed some sleep, and someone had given him sleeping pills. And so he tells a story. He's in there, and he's holding the pill, and he's about to take it, but then he flushes it down the toilet because he wants to rely on his prayer to sleep. So there's personal moments like that, but there's also big headline revelations. One big revelation is that apparently in August of 2008, when Russia was at war with Georgia, which
right,
is a U.S.
Sure, right.
ally, apparently Paulson was told that Russia had gone to the Chinese government and said to them, you know, we both own a lot of Fannie and Freddie bonds. Let's just dump them in the market. Russia and China, let's dump all those Fannie and Freddie bonds in the market to cause havoc and bring those companies down. And apparently China refused to participate in this. But this is one of the revelations in his book.
What did he say? He said some things about the election race.
He did. So he, you know, of course, was talking to the candidates, and he said that he was impressed by how engaged Obama seemed, and Obama would call him up all the time and seemed really engaged. And he did, even though he's a Republican, he was part of the Bush administration, he did say that McCain and Palin just did not seem to be very engaged, didn't call him much. And he said it kind of bothered them that Palin called him Hank in a really chummy way, and she never met him. And even though everyone calls him Hank, who knows him, he said it bothered him that
folksy
she was that.
Did not work on
it didn't
former
work.
Treasury
it didn't
Secretary
Remember, he's
Henry
a Goldman
Paulson.
CEO, though,
That's
too.
Right.
He's
a Goldman.
He's a Goldman
Hank.
Guy.
Yeah.
Louis Story is a finance and business and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Coming up, we're going to go to California. There is a crisis developing there.
At least five infants were born with either cleft palate or cleft lip.
Five infants over the course of 14 months. We're going to talk about how that could be an issue that requires intervention from the Environmental Protection Agency. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Coming up, a serious story coming out of California that has people wondering if Barack Obama is setting himself up to be Barack Brockovich. More on that in just a few moments, but here's some news stories first that we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama will propose a nearly $4 trillion budget this morning. It includes a $100 billion jobs package, plus more education spending and higher taxes on families earning more than $250,000 a year. All in all, the federal deficit will rise to a record $1.6 trillion this year. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs tells CNN they know that's a big number, but
We are not creating the jobs that we'd like to, and I think that some additional recovery and stimulus spending is important.
Along with $700 billion in cuts, there'll also be a spending freeze for many domestic programs for the next 3 years. Toyota is telling dealers they should get the parts to fix problematic gas pedals later this week, but the over 4 million customers affected by the recall will have to wait for repairs until technicians are trained to install the little steel bar. In the meantime, dealerships will be open for extended hours.
Flights carrying injured Haitians to the United States for medical treatment will resume today. They'd been suspended for several days after hospitals in Florida complained they were overloaded. Meanwhile, 10 Americans detained on suspicion of trying to take 33 children out of Haiti without proper permission will be in court today. The group says there was miscommunication over some paperwork. The country is responsible for more than 80% of the world's greenhouse gases. You know who you are, have handed in their plans for cutting their emissions by 2020, meeting a United Nations deadline. But the cuts they've promised are much smaller than most scientists say are needed to avoid dangerous levels of climate change. And a plane made an emergency landing on the New Jersey Turnpike this morning. No one was injured when the single-engine aircraft landed near Cherry Hill, but traffic is backed up for miles. Let's check the markets. Asian markets are up. European indices are mixed this morning. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow will get underway at 10,067. The S&P opens at 1,073. And the NASDAQ, looking for a much better week, opens at 2147. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Kettleman City, California is a small community of mostly Spanish-speaking residents. It's making national headlines, though, because there's been an epidemic of birth defects. They're described here by Kettleman City resident Marciela Melis Alatorre.
In the past 2 years, we've had 6 babies born with cleft palate in our town, which is a really small town. It's a town of 1,500. We know that the normal incidence of cleft palate is 1 birth in every 1,000. As it stands, we're way over what's considered the norm.
The residents of Kettleman City realize the birth defects may be the result of a giant toxic waste company right near town that's dumping PCBs into the water. The battle for the remedy has become a case study in environmental protection. Joining us now to talk about the possible shift in policy for the EPA is Jeff Young. He's the host of Public Radio International's Living on Earth, and he's here to tell us what this small town reveals about the EPA under President Obama. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, let's give some more details about this story coming out of California. Bradley Angels, the executive director of Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice, it's been critical of the EPA because, as he told The Takeaway, the EPA has ignored this problem of chemical waste in California.
Let's
for decades, you know, EPA has always said they support environmental justice. After all, they have a legal commitment to do so. For decades, they've not only ignored that commitment, they've violated it, literally talking out of both sides of their mouth. EPA has been, I guess one way of saying asleep at the wheel, but it's actually worse. They've been complicit. For example, in Kettleman City, letting chem waste dump even more polychlorinated biphenols, PCBs, really toxic chemicals, on a permit that should have expired 12 years ago. I mean, that should never happen.
So Jeff Young, host of PRI's Living on Earth, first let's kind of unpack what he's saying there. Has the, well, obviously this investigation into this chemical waste dump is not going to determine whether or not the EPA has been complicit in allowing it to happen, but have they allowed some things to slip by in terms of regulation?
Well, I think there's no question but that we've heard complaints for a long time from what are often called fence line communities. These are the places that happen to be right beside either a dump or a chemical facility or petrochemical facility. And there are pockets of these communities all across the country that suffer disproportionately the impacts of waste or effluent or emissions. And for whatever reason, those tend to get lower priority. And it's often assumed that these are because these are disenfranchised communities that don't have a strong political voice. And that's the goal of environmental justice and EPA's environmental justice program. Now, under new leadership here with Obama's administrator, Lisa Jackson, there's been a lot of rhetoric about taking more seriously the environmental justice mission of EPA. I think that this case in California may give us some early indication as to whether or not they're going to make it more than rhetoric.
How much people are talking about this is a major shift in policy for the EPA. Is that rhetoric, or if they go through and investigate this and follow through, is this actually a real shift towards pursuing environmental justice?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. You know, these problems are very complicated, though, and I would warn against very high expectations. The people who actually suffer here, they have a strong desire to get concrete answers. What's going on? I mean, we know from what's been uncovered so far in the Kettleman case that these people are suffering a disproportionate number of children born with birth defects. The numbers are there. Now, exactly why? That's where it's going to get murky, and the answers are going to be, I predict, frustrating for the people who are directly affected. And so it's unfair, I think, to expect that you're going to get concrete answers quickly. However, in a broader sense, I think this is an indication that EPA is moving toward taking environmental justice more seriously, toward targeting these things. The other big and messy part of this is the whole Superfund program, which is responsible for cleaning up a lot of these sites. It's been fairly moribund, underfunded. We're going to need to look to the Obama administration's budget, which is coming out today for EPA, to see exactly what they intend to put behind cleanup of sites like these.
Well, you know, the mission of the EPA is a broad one. It just says protect human health and the environment. So if the EPA is, if environmental justice is just part of what they do, what else are they doing for protecting human health?
Well, now that is a broad topic. Overall, you know, because we're 1 year into the administration here, I think that the key elements have been in elevating the priority of clean energy and climate change, which is a work in progress, to put it mildly, but we've seen a lot of progress along those lines, particularly the investments made by the Stimulus Act, which are record-setting in terms of trying to develop research and development on clean energy technologies. And Lisa Jackson at EPA has promised a long overdue reform of toxic chemical regulation, a system that people on both sides of the debate, the industry and the public health advocates, both say is a broken system. This so-called TSCA, the toxic chemical law, is just antiquated and needs reform.
But Jeff Young, just for the people of Kettleman City, I mean, is the EPA responsible for determining PCB levels in their drinking water, or is that just left to lawyers to figure out?
Well, the EPA has a strong role here, and I think it's interesting that the regional administrator has taken a strong role on this. And that tells you something about EPA. It doesn't always happen equally at all places. So Kettleman City is getting some action. I think there are other communities around the country who face similar issues who are saying, hey, what about us? And perhaps they'll now step up and demand more action.
Okay, Jeff Young is the host of Public Radio International's Living on Earth program. Thanks so much, Jeff. Coming up, we welcome new listeners on WLRN in Miami. But what does the rest of the country need to know about your city? Miami-based columnist David Barry has a few suggestions in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. At the Grammys last night, Elton John, one legend, Lady Gaga, a wannabe legend, both of them singing, performing at the awards ceremony, both with fake hair completely, probably the only thing they have in common. Karen Gantz, deputy editor of RollingStone.com, joins us to sort of recap the Grammy Awards last night. Lady Gaga was a spectacle and was certainly the talk of the awards, but really the award goes to Beyonce for getting a record for women performers, and there were some other things to talk about as well. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Beyonce won 6 of her 10 nominations. That's a record for the most wins by a woman in a single night at the Grammys. Pretty impressive.
You know, if you take Taylor Swift, who won Album of the Year, and Beyonce and Lady Gaga and sort of set them as a kind of pantheon of the music industry 2010, you couldn't find three bigger contrasts.
Absolutely. I mean, Beyonce is really about the perfection of the performance. Taylor Swift is kind of about songwriting craft and, you know, youthful exuberance. And Lady Gaga is kind of about the crazy, ugly side of fame.
And there's plenty of crazy, ugly side of fame that's driving record sales as much as fabulous songs, Taylor Swift, and the veteran powerhouse of a Beyonce.
It's true. You know, as women are really ruling the charts this year, they hit all the top records. And I think part of that has to do with that women are very popular in pop music, and pop music does well in a singles environment, which is kind of where we're heading. The industry has a big problem selling albums, but they're okay selling singles.
So how do you explain the fact that the Kings of Leon won? You know that I could use somebody. Guys have to get some awards, I guess, huh?
They do, actually. They had an awesome year, too. They were one of the best new rock bands around. And that song actually had a lot of pop appeal. It was played on pop radio. It was covered by Kelly Clarkson. But it's also just a really solid, kind of bluesy ballad.
Does the Grammy Awards in tone last night bespeak recovery in the music industry or still a sense of crisis? There were a lot of, you know, really diverse performers. Record sales are doing really well in a lot of sectors. Concert sales are good.
I think it was a pretty hopeful Grammys overall. I mean, as you were saying, the bent was towards youth. Last year, Robert Plant walked away with the most awards. You know, he's awesome. But I think this year the focus was more on the next generation, you know, really looking at where the industry is heading.
What was your favorite moment last night?
I know, I really did like that Lady Gaga Elton John performance. It kind of just showed how she's an amazing pop performer. She's out there dancing, and then 2 seconds later, she makes herself physically unappealing and dirty. And she's at the piano, you know, showing off against one of the greatest pianists ever. It was pretty amazing.
And keeping Elton John's career alive. Yeah. Yeah, Elton should thank her, don't you think?
Well, they both like glitter.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's true. And Taylor Swift, I mean, does this mean that next year she's a powerhouse that continues or flash in the pan?
Well, she's going on tour, a really big tour next year. I mean, she had the biggest selling album of 2009 with Fearless. I don't think she's a flash in the pan. I think her performance was a little bit weaker on the vocals, but she's very beloved. She's a very charming, appealing personality. I think we're going to see a lot of her.
And nothing can stop Beyonce.
Nothing can ever stop Beyonce. She's one of my favorites. I mean, everything about her performance just speaks to perfection. She's really sharp.
Quentin Tarantino said hip-hop is not dead in introducing Eminem and Dre and Lil Wayne. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, hip-hop is one of the most vital forms of music we have going on today. That was a pretty awesome performance, despite the censors.
Massive censors.
What you can hear of it.
You lost like 2 minutes of it, but it was great.
A little overactive.
Karen Gantz, the deputy editor of RollingStone.com, recapping the Grammys.
Thanks.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. With this program, we plunge into the Everglades. This morning, our listeners on WLRN in Miami join the Takeaway family. And coming up, What do we need to know about Miami? We're going to ask noted anthropologist and Buddhist thinker Dave Barry. You may know him also as a columnist for the Miami Herald. He's got a few suggestions in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama unveiling his $3.8 trillion budget proposal this morning. Some details: $100 billion would go into fighting unemployment. There would be a spending freeze on some government programs, and taxes would be boosted on the wealthy. It also includes a record-breaking deficit of about $1.6 trillion. Moving to education, our partner in the New York Times says the White House wants to overhaul President Bush's education law, No Child Left Behind. The administration wants to change the way the program is financed so that a portion of the money is awarded based on academic progress. Toyota President Jim Lenz appeared on NBC this morning to bring customers up to date on the company's massive recall to fix those faulty accelerator pedals.
The training has already taken place at our dealerships. Parts will be shipping today. So I think by later on this week, we will begin the process of notification to bring customers.
The training he refers to is to train the dealer technicians to install a fix on the accelerator.
In the publishing business, Amazon.com is giving in to pricing demands from publisher Macmillan on electronic books. Prices for ebook bestsellers will likely increase between $3 and $5. Moving abroad now, police in Iraq say at least 41 people have been killed after a female suicide bomber detonated an explosives belt while walking among Shiite pilgrims in northern Baghdad. And in Haiti, aid agencies are rushing to find thousands of children made homeless by the earthquake, many of whom are still roaming the streets. This comes as 10 Americans are in court today on suspicion of trying to take 33 children out of the country without permission. This pastor is from the same Idaho church as many of the Americans being held, and he says it was an honest mistake.
It was just largely a misunderstanding that they thought they had the paperwork they needed. It appears that they were missing a particular document.
With more details, we're joined now by BBC reporter Nick Davis in Port-au-Prince. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. Good morning.
Their court date is today. What are they being charged with?
Well, at the moment, it's pretty unclear as to what exactly is going to happen. They still have to go before a commission meeting later on today, just to find out whether or not they're actually going to face charges and what might actually happen if they're going to go before a judge and actually take some form of responsibility over what happened.
Who are the kids and where are they at this point?
At the moment, they're being looked after by SOS Children's Villages, a charity, an Austrian charity based in Port-au-Prince on the outskirts. The children, it seems as if they were taken from an area, or if anything, picked up from an area not far from here, Delmar. From what we're gathering, it seems as if these children were introduced by the people from New Life Children's Refuge by a local Haitian pastor. From there on in, we're very unclear as to what actually happened. The charity say that they were actually children from an orphanage. They were taken from an orphanage and they didn't have parents. But we're hearing very, very contradictory sort of messages coming out. One of the children apparently saying that she had parents and that as far as she was concerned, she was being taken to a boarding school, a summer camp.
Okay, and this is Nick Davis, correspondent for our partner, the BBC in Haiti, with a rooster behind him telling him to get to work. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Good morning, Miami. We are welcoming Miami listeners to The Takeaway this week at WLRN. There is no one sound of Miami. That's the Afro-Cuban sound of Mario Bauza, who actually broke the color line performing live in Miami back in the 1940s. But there are many Miamis, and we want to bring them to you all this week as we welcome our new listeners. And to begin, we're going to talk with Dave Barry, the Miami-based Pulitzer Prize-winning humor columnist. He's a legend in Miami and outside of Miami. He's the author of I'll Mature When I'm Dead. That's his latest book, Dave Barry's Amazing Tales of Adulthood. It'll be out this May. Dave, good morning.
Hey, John, how are you?
Pretty good. Are the people of Miami going to forgive us for first day on the air and we get you?
Not the Chamber of Commerce, no. I don't think so.
Really?
No, I consider myself an ambassador for Miami. I love this city, and I've loved it ever since I moved here in 1986 from the United States. It's just different, you know. But we have people have a bad image of the city, and I personally would like to correct. There's a poll they do, the Zogby people do,
right?
Where they ask, you know, people what their views of what their impressions of certain areas are. And in Miami, one of the things people always say is they think of it as a dangerous, violent place. And those of us who live here are hurt by that. We want to track those people down and kill them because it's a wonderful city.
Yeah.
I love it.
And that would be helpful. Now, we met years and years ago. We did
at the airport.
That's right, at the airport.
Did you ever catch that flight?
I did catch the flight. But you had gone to New York to do a piece about something the New York Times did in the magazine called Can Miami Save Itself? And you marched up with the expense account of the Miami Herald to do Can New York Save Itself? There's a tradition of you and Miami kind of saying, hey, stick it to the rest of the country when they criticize Miami. Why is that?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like we know we have our flaws, but that was pretty funny. That was a situation, I believe it was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And New York was not exactly an earthly paradise in the 80s.
Indeed.
And we had this well-known problem with big-time drug dealing and all going on for a while down here. And New York Times discovered it like 10 years after this gigantic front page story, Can Miami Save Itself? And so that we thought would be, you know, that's very polite and unkind of New York to find that we have flaws. But we have a longstanding sort of antagonism here for the New Yorkers. I am one of them. I'm a New Yorker originally, but I don't do what a lot of my fellow New Yorkers do, which is come down here, live here, spend the rest of their lives here, and never stop complaining about how much better the York airs, and our feeling is, okay, go on back, you know, go get on that number two subway if you really liked it that much, but we're fine here.
You know, when I was reporting in Chicago back in the 80s, Chicago was a great story. It was an international city. It also had a real sense of its identity. Miami, I think, is a similar kind of story. It has an intense sort of connection with the rest of the world, certainly in the Western Hemisphere, but there's something about Miami that also helps not simply a journalist, but a columnist get ahead. I mean, you and Carl Hyacin find more fantastic, almost unbelievable stories to tell about Miami. It seems like there's no place else in the world like it.
That's true. There's a whole genre of South Florida crime fiction. And as Carl Hyacin has said many times, you don't need an imagination. You just need a subscription to the newspaper. We had a story. Okay. I mean, we could do nothing for the next hour, but I could tell you. But I'll just tell you one. This happened last year.
Okay.
And it was made the Miami Herald. There was a shark, a live shark, on our people mover. a couple of guys had been fishing in Biscayne Bay and caught a 6-foot nurse shark, and they wanted to sell it at one of the fish wholesalers downtown. And I guess this is why we have a people mover. I don't know why we don't just call it the shark mover. But anyway, they thought, well, we'll just take public transportation with this shark. So they got, and the shark was still alive at this point. I apologize to all the animal lovers out there, but this is a true story. The shark was alive when they got on the train with it. And I got an email from a commuter who she took a picture of the shark with her phone and sent it to me. She said, this is Miami. There's a live shark on the train. So we could have theoretically had a situation where somebody was bitten by a shark. It didn't happen. And I just want to stress that to visitors. There have been zero shark bites on the people mover in Miami, whatever you may have heard. But that's a story that is unlikely to occur in, say, Cleveland.
And emblematic of a city where you just said you don't need an imagination to tell an amazing story. But then it's, of course, the location of Disney World, right?
That's a low blow, John. No, we don't even talk about it.
He's speechless.
Are you speechless?
But you know, these columnists that we're talking about, including yourself, you guys pick on Miami. It's when other people pick them on Miami that you have a problem.
That's right, because they're not down here dodging bullets with us. That's our feeling.
Well, we are thrilled to have Miami part of the voice of the Takeaway. Who do you imagine will be the first listener who calls our spin box number 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us about something that's going on in Miami?
I don't know that they'll call. They may just show up in person.
And we would love that. We would love that. Actually, 160 Varick Street is our address here in New York City. Dave, you come and visit us sometime, all right?
Yeah, good luck with the show down here.
Thanks, Dave.
Bye.
Dave Barry, humor columnist and author of numerous books based in Miami, Florida, and a columnist for the Miami Herald, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald. Welcome, Miami.
And if you are from Miami or anywhere else you want to grab our podcast, you can go to thetakeaway.org. You can also check on our coverage of on Haiti. Here's a takeaway from today.
Haiti is not Afghanistan. Afghanistan, I think, is hard. Haiti, I think, is easy.
That's Paul Collier, a former special advisor on Haiti to the United Nations Secretary General. You can listen back to the stories of tragedy, survivors, and a blog post from a Takeaway intern who traveled there to help out more. That's on thetakeaway.org. We also have a special for you, the State of the Union playlist. All last week, we asked you for the song that best sum up the nation right now, from indie rockers to gospel to Motown and pop. You delivered. So go to thetakeaway.org and you can listen to the songs that you suggested as the description of the country today. I'm Celeste Headlee.
The State of the Union album comes out later this year from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.